This meeting is now being recorded.
Yeah.
Sorry. Like my court reporter says, just stop. We're on item four on the agenda, which is a presentation from Alameda. I'm going to allow Judge Jacobson to make introductions of the folks that are here with him. But before we do that, a little bit of background. Judge Jacobson has communicated with numerous individuals and entities concerning this proposal. He and I engaged in discussions. I think it started off with a lunch, an in-person lunch in late March, early April. Judge Jacobson and I know each other from our birth as judges, that is, at the Judicial College and new judges. So we are very respectful of each other and our backgrounds, and he brings a very unique and important perspective to this issue. I have been candid with Judge Jacobson, and while we have perhaps had some disagreements, respectful as they were, that the timing on this dictates that it be part of our work plan coming up based upon existing judicial counsel and previously approved procedures and policies concerning adjustments to WAFM. Given that, I will turn it over to Judge Jacobson and the folks with him for this presentation. We have an hour on the agenda for this, and I will obviously honor that hour if necessary, but Judge Jacobson has shared that he too has other things to do, and he anticipates this presentation may be well shorter than that, though obviously not necessary. Judge?
You ever heard a lawyer give a time estimate? Ever trust it? With me is our CEO, Chad Finke, and also our assistant presiding judge, Judge Wynn Carville. So Judge Carville, I anticipate, is going to be the presiding judge in 2018 and 19, and he's very interested in financial issues. The way that we're going to proceed is I think he's going to begin and cover a couple of topics. The idea here is not to drill down into the weeds and the details, but rather just talk about some higher-level concepts, both about this year and years going forward. With that, Mr. Finke.
Thanks, Judge Jacobson, and thank you, Judge Conklin, and members of the subcommittee for allowing us to speak. As Judge Conklin referenced, we conceptualized this as thinking we're going to come in here and ask for a vote, but then because of the work plan issue, it's now sort of just informational. And as you all are thinking about the work plan for next year and you know, going forward, we kind of just wanted to tee up some of our observations, issues, things we hope you'll think about and consider as you're, you know, thinking about what comes in year six and beyond. So many of you have heard us say in the past that what we were hoping for year five was a pause and study. Obviously, that's, you know, the ship has sailed on that. It's not going to happen. But the reasons we were asking for that, at least, we were very convinced, based on our own WAFM projections, that we were going to go sailing off the cliff as of July 1. And we had sort of fairly robust layoff plans drawn up and, you know, kind of ready to deal with that. We then got Zlatko's email that came out, was it last month? Whenever the email came out with sort of the preliminary numbers, and learned that we weren't going off the cliff. And so that was good news for us, just in the sense that it looks like, you know, our budget is going to be basically flat for next year, maybe just with a slight uptick. But our concern remains that with WAFM, the way it currently operates, it is too unpredictable, and it seems set up so that every year somebody's going off a cliff. So it wasn't us this year. By how I look at it, it looks like it was Mike Ewan who went off the cliff. And I've talked to Mike, and he's, you know, doing what he needs to do. But I think any model where in some year or another somebody's going to crash into the ground, it's very concerning. And the fact that you, maybe I'm just not smart enough, but it doesn't seem like anyone is able to figure out with any degree of certainty who exactly it's going to be that's going to hit the ground until 6 weeks before it happens. And so that, you know, that's sort of largely concerning. And if you look at the information the Judicial Council put out in July of 2016, So the packet of WAFM information with all the spreadsheets, and I think it was Schedule K, I think, that had a prediction as to what everybody's WAFM cuts were potentially going to look like for 17-18. You see, I think Steve Nash in Contra Costa is one of these courts that's always at the swing, right? But if you look at that, you see, I'll pick on you, Judge Compton, but I mean, the numbers that came out a year ago, it looked like Fresno was going to potentially go up 750,000. The numbers that just came out, you're actually down 577,000. And I'm not making any commentary on whether you planned for that or not. But
we did.
Okay. Merced, you know, they looked like they were going to go up 112,000. They went down 297,000. So it's just this, as a CEO, right, just from the narrow perspective of a CEO, I find it nerve-wracking not to know until 6 weeks before the beginning of the new fiscal year what is going to happen. I don't need to know if my cut's going to be yay or yay, but I need to know if it's going to, you know, what zone it's going to be in. So this unpredictability of the model and the timing, I guess I'll call it, or the cycle of the numbers, it's just I don't see how we can continue out into the future. I mean, I've sort of accepted, okay, year five, fine, but it's hard to see how we can keep this up year after year, not, you know, just with this ambiguity. So, you know, what we were planning to ask for, again, the pause and study, which we were sort of viewing in our minds as, okay, 17-18 will then be essentially a hold harmless type of year, right? So nobody gets any more money, but nobody takes any more hits. We thought that would give the committee time to think about what comes next. And also, I mean, even if the answer was we all love WAF and we want to stick with it, well, at least then there would have been this sort of year lag time baked in, right? So we could have moved forward with these numbers that Zlatko just put out, but for 18-19, so that there would always be this year lag time. I know some of the other courts, I suspect, now that the work plan has been broadened the way that Judge Conklin said, I suspect there will be courts that if you send out the email that you just referenced a little while ago, I think one of the proposals you're probably going to get is something about building some sort of a delay in, you know, even if nothing else about WAFM changes, at least build in a delay from when the numbers come out from finance to when those numbers actually go into effect. And so I hope that proposal is made. I don't know that it's something that we're going to make, but I hope it's made. I'm glad to hear that the view of this group is that item one on your work plan for next year is very broad, because I think Judge Jacobson is going to talk more about our idea about the population model. I do think there are probably a lot of other ideas and models out there that will come forward. One thing I've talked to a few folks about, it's hard to know exactly what to call it, but it's some notion of a rate freeze, right? So decide on a point at which everybody's shares are locked in. So I think our share for next year is now 3.83. Lock that in, or call it 4 years, right? And then say, okay, after 4 years, we reevaluate so that you're still kind of WAFMing it, but instead of doing it every year where you're fluctuating like this, maybe you smooth out the fluctuations. So I hope that's something that, you know, maybe can be looked at. And I hope that I know there was a discussion a little while ago about whether all of the parking lot items were or were not accounted for, and I certainly have not gone back through the minutes of this group since its founding, but I know one of the parking lot items that we have focused a lot on was this need for a very robust audit function, so that if we are going to stick with WAFM and we are going to stick with filings, that there's just some analysis to make sure that we are all indeed reporting that in the same way. And so I know that was a parking lot item from when WAFM, the very first report that ever adopted WAFM, and I'm not sure where that has been over the course of this group's history, but I hope that's something that if it has not been discussed and, you know, moved on from, that can be part of the discussion in the coming year as well. So I think what we're hoping for, whatever it is that results in year six and beyond, that it is more predictable. I mean, that's the big thing, is just being able to plan for what's coming so that we can deal with multi-year labor contracts and we can deal with, you know, multi-year vendors. I mean, I think probably all the CEOs in this room probably have a contract with Thomson Reuters for your Westlaw service. in my experience, they don't really do one-year contracts, or if you do a one-year contract with them, you get a very terrible rate. So they want you to lock in for multiple years, but it's sort of hard to know, can I commit to spending this amount of money on my Westlaw for the next 5 years when I really don't have any clue what the year, what 12 months and 3 days from now is going to look like or whatever. So the other piece that we were going to ask for and that I hope is still, I don't know how to tee this up in time. So not obviously I can't ask you all for a vote, but this related issue that we had of if we can't pause WAFM for year five, related to the concept of a hold harmless, that we somehow, I guess, request that the council set aside its adopted procedures for the $10 million emergency reserve. I know there's a whole set of criteria about, you know, how the council doles that out, but to do a 1 year set aside of those criteria and instead use that $10 million to backstop the donor courts. I did quick math on the numbers that Zlatko sent out. It looks like, if I did it right, it looks like all of the donor courts for 17-18, the total comes out to about $15 million. So that $10 million really wouldn't be enough. But I'm sure, you know, there could be some, you could say, well, give it to the smaller courts first, right? On the theory that, you know, that the value of a dollar is more for a smaller court. So again, I know I can't ask you all to vote on that, and I don't know procedurally where we go with that concept.
I think it's Judicial Branch Budget Committee. I think they're the ones, and that's Judge Rubin's committee.
Okay.
They're the ones that make any decisions related to the $10 million fund.
Okay.
So I'm not trying to dismiss your suggestion, but I don't think it's one that this group can consider.
Sure, and part of that, you know, part of it is, I mean, obviously we're addressing you all as members of this committee, but you're all also judicial branch leaders, right? Your PJs, your CEOs, and I mean, you know, I've been in the branch long enough to know that sometimes if we got it to that committee, they might pick up the phone and say, well, Judge Conklin, what do you think about this, right? So it's not just asking you as committee members, but just to ask you to sort of think about these kind of concepts. Because I do think, you know, I mean, even though, like I said, we found ourselves not as a donor court this year, I would suspect that a number of the donor courts who maybe didn't, you know, guess correctly or plan correctly are thinking, man, we could use some relief. And I think that would be, if, you know, if the appropriate committee and leaders can be persuaded, I think that would be a good use of that $10 million. I also think, I mean, we still do have a few weeks until the legislature has to get the budget done. You know, I've wondered whether it's worth the branch trying to put together some kind of last-minute push to convince the legislature and Jerry to throw just 15 more million, right? 15 million to backstop the donor courts. In the grand scheme of things, it's nothing. And I don't know if the JCC has made any legislative effort, but, you know, again, I want to keep repeating it, that whole harmless notion, right, that the donor courts, not to take away from the courts that are more under-resourced and need the money, but to sort of stop the cutting on those courts that, you know, have been cut year over year. So those are the kind of the sort of big picture things that I wanted to talk about. I think, unless anybody has any questions or think I missed anything, I'm ready to turn it over to you.
Okay. So suppose I'll start this way, which is we came up with the population to judge ratio to stimulate conversation about an alternative to WAFM. And spend a lot of time looking at WAFM. I suppose the universal truth is that it's very hard to understand. I've been fairly deep in the weeds, I suspect, compared to most judges in California on WAFM, maybe not as much as you guys, but since 2013 when it was adopted. There are various aspects of it. No matter how much I read the spreadsheets, I don't understand. Since WAFM's been in existence, I've probably been to the state legislature 30 times to ask for money. Not once have I had any success in explaining WAFM in the 15 or 20 seconds that I get while they're listening. I think that very much harms our budget advocacy. I think when you go to other levels of it, the fact that we cannibalize one another, that we go back and forth, makes it nearly impossible, unless we get full funding, makes it nearly impossible for us to come together and speak with one voice. There's no question in my mind that our strongest posture advocating for budget is if we're all making the same ask, if we're speaking as a unit. And this is at a point where this has divided us. Just as some general ideas that I have come up with, one is I spent a lot of time in the last 6 months in the GPSIS manual, not on the workload assessment portion, but in the filings portion. So I have no opinion on the workload side. It seems to me that we could make a decision to simply issue a list of acceptable filings, that there could be a debate about what should be on that list, and then step completely around GPSIS. And that saves a lot of work in terms of upgrading GPSIS and clarifying it. It takes away the factor of, depending on what your professional discipline is, you might look at things in there very differently. I'm fluent in criminal law. I'm not fluent in other areas of law. But I would say I continue to scratch my head over the fact that you cannot count probation violations because they're part of an open case that you have. And you also cannot count probation transfers in because in one circumstance we're being told that there's not been a final disposition, and the other circumstance we're being told that it's a post-disposition. It's one or the other. You have to be able to count one category or the other. I actually had I cover our court's criminal writs, and I actually had a case where when I looked at it, it's a poster child case for this point. The case was a probation transfer in for us. The guy was not a compliant probationer. We went through 5 different revocations on the guy. Ultimately, we sent him to state prison. Now he's filed a couple of different writs from state prison because they weren't habeas writs. They had to do with some other issue or another, Prop 57 or what have you. We have done, I don't know, 4 separate rounds of bringing the guy into court with new paperwork being filed. There was an evidentiary hearing at one point. We sent him to state prison. We're now into the second writ with him. We haven't been able to count one iota of that work because under GPSIS interpretation, this was a case that didn't originate with us. It was transferred to us. And it might be that we'd be better off engaged in a debate about what kinds of filings should we be counting and then simply publish a list. And that removes a lot of the mystery and difficulty here. If I don't have any bias against filings, except that filings present an enormous amount of difficulty in terms of getting us to a point where we're apples to apples. So maybe the first layer of the problem with filings is that most of us have dissimilar data collection process. There's some courts that have no case management system whatsoever. We are a court that we've been working off of a system that was born in 1973. You say felonies from us, you get an aggregate number without any kind of breakdown. There are other courts with better systems, newer systems, that are able to break it down. That makes it enormously difficult to tell whether everyone's counting the same things in the same way. If you drill down a level further with filings, I was just talking to Mr. Roddy about this a little bit, you get into things where there are different cultures from county to county. So when we did our self-audit of our filings, again, I don't have a great understanding of other areas besides criminal, but I became aware, not so much in civil, but in probate, there were some issues like this. There were some issues in juvenile, and there were some issues in family, all related to depending on how you initiate sort of a secondary action. So to use the example of 1058. You have someone in 1058 court because there's a child support issue. Some point, those parties bring a child custody issue. So when you move into that sort of spinoff from that, depending on how you've done it, it will count as a filing or it won't. In the area of prosecutions, very recently there was a bunch of stuff in the newspaper about Attorney General Sessions sending out a memo to U.S. attorneys saying he wants the harshest, highest-level charges that are provable to be alleged. In my county, we have a long history of taking care of people by probation violation whenever possible, and we have not been a revolving door send people back to prison county. We have avoided that. This isn't something new. This has been the culture in our county. We have much more sort of the liberal influence, if you will, as opposed to other places that perhaps are more conservative in their views on these things. There are other counties in my years on CDAA, there are other counties I was aware that their natural practice was to file a new charge every single time. And so by simply measuring filings, it's very hard to tell what the actual cost is to the court. So it would mean you'd have to drill down still yet a further layer deeper to figure out what factors can you reach to that will equalize the filing so that you understand what's the amount of effort that it takes in court. RAS model covers that to some extent, and to some extent you run into the same problems because it's based on the same disparate filings. Another thought that has occurred to me is that it seems like Los Angeles is very different from all the rest of us. The small courts, the two-judge courts, are very different from the rest of us. And almost like maybe those two, we ought to figure out some way to set aside L.A. with a percentage, some way to take care of the small courts in a way because they have problems that the rest of us don't have, and focus most of our allocation methodology work on the courts that are in between those two poles. So when you look at courts with, say, a dozen judges up to, Mr. Roddy, how many do you got in San Diego? 160, 170?
134.
So courts in that range, there's a lot more similarity. There's a lot more common ground. The issues look a lot more, they're able to be dealt with in perhaps more similar methods. L.A. has a set of problems, as best I can tell, and issues that none of us can wrap around. None of us have anything that's close to that. To be in a small court where the funding floor and the BLS keeps you down so you can't keep employees, that's not something that most of us have any experience with. Another general point is it's my view that whatever we go to in the future, whether it's WAFM or anything else, we need to absolutely get away from the historic share concept. That was a fundamentally unfair thing in the first place. And it has no basis in reason. And one of the things I think that's been fantastic about WAFM is it has caused the process of weaning away from the historic share to begin. You guys know that I'm kind of hung up on population and stuff like that. So what I would say about the historic share is my court's historic share is 4.83%, but we only got 4% of the population. There's something that's fundamentally unfair about that. Of course, I could say that my WAFM number is 3.6. Well, anyway. But the historic share thing has been sort of an institutionalized, in many ways, an evil. When I look at a county next door to ours, San Joaquin County, they have been nearly obliterated by the historic share. And I think what it goes back to is historically they didn't have a good relationship with their board of supervisors, and maybe at the time of unification they didn't have the most effective representation in the state legislature. That can't be a basis for keeping a court down for 25 years. That's a really bad idea. So I think we ought to get completely away from the historic share. On the issue of predictability, sort of to piggyback on what Mr. Finke was just saying, between the very the high level of responsiveness that WAFM has, in other words, you get big jumps up and down based on a three-year average, and then there's a year that goes by before it's implemented. And sort of what I was thinking about was, you know, we had that horrible warehouse fire in Oakland where 36 people died. And just last week, we had the news trucks and the lawyers on the steps, and they're filing a whole slew of wrongful death cases against everyone from the owners of the building to the fire department for inspections to PG&E for allowing electricity to be on when they should have known that people were using extension cords and stuff like that. Okay, so we're going to get a big bubble of wrongful death cases that's going to go through. And I don't know that we should have a system that is so responsive on the one hand that it's going to push some of our filings up and sort of give us more money for that, but it's not going to happen in the time that we're dealing with the case, at least not the first 2 years of it. So we'll get some sort of blip a couple of years down the road. Suppose we do an enormous amount of work on those cases, and then we're successful and those cases resolve. And by the time we get that money, we're no longer dealing with that workload. So we didn't get the help in the time when we needed it, and we're getting some sort of windfall later on. So
I think when you talk about predictability, that you need something that moves less nimbly to some extent. And I've had the idea of a four-year cycle where you establish everyone's baseline at the start of that. You collect filings for that period of time. In the last 6 months, you do a very robust audit of everyone in order to determine what it's going to be in the next phase. And that allows you to do the three-year union contracts that you need to do and the Westlaw contracts and the janitorial service contracts and whatever other things there are. So I would say this, is that the number one most important thing in all of this that I would hope that is a takeaway that we can achieve, we got to stop cutting ourselves. We have to stop cutting ourselves. We got to go to hold harmless and grow. If we have a difference in the relative resource levels, of course, we find some courts to be more underfunded than others, we grow those courts faster. If the governor of the legislature comes in and gives us a 2% cut, all 58 courts should take a 2% cut in their budget. We ought to be able to identify at some point in the future where we're at the level, whatever you want to call it, adequately funded. I don't want to say fully funded. I'm sort of afraid of that phrase. Where we're adequately funded. And at that point, when we get a 2% increase, everybody gets a 2% increase. But we've got to stop cutting people. Our court went through 8 years of cuts in a row, the same 4 years that everybody did on the recession, and then 4 years of Waffen. We are beaten down in so many ways. There's some other courts that are in that circumstance. Maybe there's some other courts that are starting into that. Some of these fluctuations that we saw on May 15th when the most recent Waffen allocation came out, there's a whole group of new losers in there. And we don't have to do it that way. We don't have to do it that way. So certainly I'm in favor of taking that $10 million and offsetting the losses of the donor courts, whether that's a proportional share or some other method. But as soon as we stop cutting ourselves, then one of the things I was saying, you know, Mr. Roddy was making the point that, you know, we went and in good faith, we came up with the Waffen formulation in hopes of getting funding from the governor, and that sort of didn't come. And I'll just say to you, only Santa Clara and us are in this situation, I think, but we're doing a repeat of that with the judicial vacancies and shifting them south. That this is being done in an effort to encourage the governor to authorize or fund some of those new judgeships. I'm guessing he's not going to do that. Meanwhile, we will have mayor offering at the altar. And then Mr. Roddy suggested that we shouldn't offer any more self-pain until they show us some money. And I could not agree more with that. I think Mr. Roddy is right where we need to be. But a part of that is we got to stop cutting ourselves. We got to stop building one court up on the pain of another. So those are just the points. I would certainly like to participate at some level in these discussions as we look at Waffen going forward. I suffer from thinking about stuff a little bit too much and then ideas, many of them very poor. Once in a while, a nugget of goodness in there. A lot of ideas flash across my head. So I want to say that, you know, the population judge ratio was an effort to articulate an idea about how we could do this differently. I don't know that that's necessarily the idea. I'm not an economist. I'm not a statistician. But we need to find a way to stop hurting ourselves and to come together as a group and go forward and be much more successful at this money game. So that's what I had to say.
Very good.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question for you. And I've read your proposal several times. And I have a question, but I think I actually know the answer after you talking about the filings. In your proposal of judged population, are you talking about actual judges or authorized positions, or are you talking about, as defined by the workload, what your adjusted positions are?
Authorized positions. So to the extent that I can claim an altruistic motive, what I would say to you is we were well aware at the time that we came up with this, we were well aware that we were on the chopping block for losing some judgeships. So you'll see in that
those hypotheticals that we provided, that it shows us at 75 we would go to 73, and that would be a significant chunk of money that we would lose. But it would be based on authorized judgeships. Idea being that we would then push to get the judge, the courts, particularly Riverside and San Bernardino, up to the level where they need to be in terms of judgeships, which means a lot more money would go to them. So did that answer?
No, absolutely. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Just two quick comments, if I could. So one, on the audit of filings, just to let you know. So that has been on the work plan. It's not a study methodology item. That's a CAC item, or executive advisory committee. There, that has now been separated out even from CAC, and now the audit group, internal audit group from the JCC, is conducting an audit of filings when they come out to courts. As they're piloting it right now, what the courts are doing is they develop their procedures. So that is an at least, some partial answer, at least, to yours. You know, maybe it's not fast enough, but that's where that stands. And then in terms of GPSIS itself, also similarly there, you know, GPSIS, CAC is responsible for GPSIS definitions in the GPSIS manual, so which that's now on the work group related to the GPSIS subcommittee. So there will be more work coming along there. There is a very, in fact, it's on the CAC agenda for next week, a very aggressive schedule to go through the entire GPSIS manual between now and January to review all the existing filings definitions. Just going to be a lot of work. So for all of the core execs who are listening, we'll talk more about it next week, but there's going to be a lot of work between now and December there again to knowing continuity is getting those updated by January. So, of course, know what the definitions would be for July. So there is work to be done. So just
I would encourage you to work, Chad Finke, really hard. I do it all the time. I get pretty good results from it.
Well, you just got tossed under the bus.
I'd like to make a comment. One of the things that we reacted strongly to the idea that WAFM was going to be rolled out maybe to 100%, and given our experience of fluctuations in WAFM, the idea that it would go ultimately to 100% was frightening. And we took comfort in the historical piece because although it has all the flaws that Judge Jacobs said, at least it provided a core of stability. So one thing I just throw out is even if the group stays with something like WAFM, instead of going to 100%, to provide that element of stability, take something like the population model and put that in instead of the historical. Do something so you don't go to a higher percent of something that is so volatile. Look for something to provide ballast and stability. And I like Judge Jacobs' proposal, but even if it's rejected, look to something like that to provide the ballast if you're not going to, if you're going to abandon the historical. Something so that it's just not so up and down.
Any other questions? Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Your materials were included in the handout, so everybody has those materials, including the charge prepared. And so,
thanks for the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, so that gets us to the end of our formal agenda for the day. I think as we one of the things we noted was, and I think it'll go up pretty quick, is we're going to make every attempt to get a hard set schedule when hopefully most of us either being in the room or being on the phone, so we can, not that we haven't been to work, but that so we can get to work. Any other comments? Anything else?
Question about that. Terms end September. So will we be setting that hard schedule before or after?
Remain optimistic.
You're not going anywhere, I can tell.
Optimistic is open to definition.
I remain optimistic.
Sam submitted your renewal for you.
As to whether or not your question is directly, will this subcommittee change? I think we have to. I don't know. I can't speak for the chief. Obviously, I wouldn't pretend to. But let's just assume it won't for the purpose of setting that schedule.
Okay. my question then was, will we be setting the schedule before that? And yes.
OS. Yep. We got to get to work well before that.
Got it.
My complaint was submitted by the former executive officer at Riverside.
I find it helpful if we could pick like the third whatever of the month, you know,
so it's consistent.
Give us like kind of predictable schedule.
Yeah, I think so.
I know that doesn't work for everybody, but I find those evidence.
I agree. And there's, I mean, we're going to be together so often, there's options about locations, including Fresno and things like that, to make it easier on people as we move on those dates. But, and we'll, you know, we could think about earlier or later meetings in the day just to make it as best possible feasible for everybody. Because I reckon it takes time away from all of our other day jobs.
So the other thing to think about is maybe a 2-day meeting if we can crunch that much work, because, again, it's less time away.
Yeah.
Right.
Once you're there, you're there.
And once we get rolling, I've noticed the same thing. We get momentum up.
Totally productive day.
Retreat. Yes.
There you go. I second that. All right, retreat to Fresno.
I don't have to worry.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Travel safe. And we'll be in close touch. And please don't forget the Tick Back meeting on Thursday, June 8th. All right, it's also in Sacramento. We'll be in a bigger room that day.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Rebecca, did you get back on the phone?
Talk to you soon. Let me know.
Great. Take care.
No, it's not 1 o'clock yet.
About Honda. Give out. Let me know.
I think it's just me, Judge.
The host has left the meeting. So at this time, the meeting will come to an end. Thank you, and goodbye.